This episode of the Security Ledger podcast is sponsored by CyberSN. CyberSN specializes in permanent and contract staffing for cybersecurity, information security, and security sales professionals. With a national and international reach, CyberSN dramatically decreases the frustration, time, and cost associated with job searching and hiring for cybersecurity professionals. CyberSN's proprietary technology platform uses a cybersecurity common language to create job descriptions and understand the job seeker's actual experience. In short, CyberSN makes job searching and hiring simpler while creating higher retention rates. For more information, visit cybersn.com. Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's podcast, episode number 111, everyone knows that cybersecurity talent is hard to come by and even harder to keep. But why does precious cyber talent walk? And what are the times of year when that critical team member is most likely to start sniffing around new opportunities? In our second segment this week, we're joined by Deidre Diamond, the founder of information security placement firm CyberSN, who will talk to us about the trend she's seeing in information security hiring and what it takes to find and hold on to valuable information security professionals. But first, our very earliest conceptions of malicious computer hacking, like the 1980s movie War Games, imagine the possibility that computer mischief might have real-world consequences. But now, fully 35 years after that movie came out, we may finally be on the precipice of an era in which cyber attacks with physical consequences are the rule rather than the exception. The fast-growing Internet of Things is wiring the machines that populate our homes, our businesses, and communities. The consequences of this are yet to be fully comprehended, but author Bruce Schneier is giving it a shot in his latest book, Click Here to Kill Everybody. Schneier does a deep dive into the security implications of the internet becoming physical. In this conversation with the Security Ledger, Bruce and I talk about the dangers that the Internet of Things poses and why he thinks that government oversight of at least some aspects of the Internet of Things are inevitable.
Bruce Schneier, and I am a fellow and lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, at the Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and I work at IBM Security. Well, this book is really about what happens when computers become physical. So my last book, Data and Goliath, was about data and privacy, and very much about surveillance capitalism, Snowden revelations, how powers are using our data. This book is different. It's not about privacy. It's about security. It's about what happens when computers can affect the world in a direct physical manner. So let me step back for a second. You know, those of us in the security community tend to look at the CIA triad: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Most of the time, we think about security in terms of confidentiality, privacy, data thefts. So that's Cambridge Analytica, misuse of our data. That's the OPM hack. The Chinese stole U.S. person's data. That's Equifax, right? Data thefts, data misuse. When you get to physical computers, integrity and availability thefts matter, attacks matter a lot more because they directly affect life and property. So in this book, I'm writing about cars and power plants and thermostats and medical devices. And sure, it worries me that someone hacks into my hospital and steals my private patient medical records, but it worries me more that they change my blood type. Or in the car context, right? They could use the microphone to eavesdrop on my conversations, but they could also disable the brakes. That's an availability attack. So that's what I'm writing about. I'm writing about computers becoming physical and the security implications.
So you sort of reluctantly coined this term, the Internet plus, in this book, which you describe as the Internet plus things plus us. Could you describe kind of what you mean by that and why it's important to distinguish the Internet plus from just the Internet?
And I hate defining terms. I really wish
there too late. Are. You already did it.
I was stuck. Right? The Internet of Things is this imperfect term to sort of mean the Internet of not screens. Computers and phones, we're used to interacting with computers through a screen we stare at. And my belief is that's going to largely change, that computers will embed themselves in our environments like our refrigerator or our car or our thermostat. You know, some of them have screens sort of, but not really. They're just part of our world. So that's the Internet of Things. But I was talking about something bigger. And I said, look, it's the Internet plus things, plus those large databases, plus the people. And I kept saying plus, 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 and came up with Internet plus. All right. It's not a great term, but I needed something to encompass the totality of everything. And the IoT didn't do it. The Internet didn't do it. So Internet plus it is.
And who are the players, if we were going to call that, who are the players on the Internet plus?
It's everybody. Because, I mean, I make this point early in my book, everything is becoming a computer. And I think there's a conceptual shift here. Things used to have computers in them, and now they are computers with things attached to them. So that refrigerator is a computer that keeps things cold, and my microwave oven is a computer that makes things hot, and an ATM machine is a computer with money inside, and mm-hmm. a car is a computer with four wheels and an engine. Mm-hmm. So what's happening, and this is interesting from us in the security community, we're used to computer companies and how we've spent a good few decades working with them on how to do security right. And now suddenly it's every company, it's appliance companies, it's toy companies, it's consumer goods companies are now making computers. And all of those lessons that it took us decades to learn, it seems like they're being learned again. The players are now everybody. Your toothbrush is going to have a computer in it.
You mentioned one of my, what I think is a really interesting topic these days, and that we've spent a fair amount of time talking about on Security Ledger podcast, which is software as a means of control. In other words, it's not just that all of our devices are becoming computers, but in the process of becoming software driven, our relationship to them as devices changes from one of ownership to one of more or less leasing. And you talk about John Deere and some of the things that they've done with their farm equipment. Talk about that just a little bit and how you see that figuring into this bigger problem of insecurity, I guess.
As companies realize they can extract revenue from us by holding back features. So the John Deere story is they license their tractor software and limit what farmers can do to repair them. You remember Keurig coffee machines would check to make sure you weren't using a third-party unlicensed K-cup.
Sure.
Through software.
Inkjet printers.
And they sort of again and again, companies are realizing, hey, we have software in here. So the normal way of commerce where I sold you the thing and had no further control of what you did with it changes. And if I sell you an ebook, I can not only monitor what pages you read and sell that to advertisers or back to the publisher, I can limit it. I can charge you extra if you want to do text-to-speech. I can charge you extra if you want to mm-hmm. make the font bigger. I mean, again and again and again.
I can keep you from transferring the book to another person, right?
Right. So I can put any controls I want, and those are software controls. So in order for me to do that, I need to implement some security features, so me, the manufacturer. So here is my conundrum. I give you the thing, but I need to put security in against your interests. So now sort of me as a consumer, I have this device, and I own it, and a piece of it inside is working against me. It's working against my interests. That piece can be leveraged by attackers because it is very much like malware. It's a piece of software on your device you don't want, and it's not acting in your interest. It's malware. Right. So the same mechanisms used to make that work can be and have been leveraged by attackers to work against you. So that trend is dangerous for security.
We saw this years ago, right, Bruce, with the Sony rootkit on their CDs.
But Sony rootkit's a prime example. Sony put that in not because they want to, you know, attack their users, because they want to make sure their users don't do things that go against the license. So they had to put in this piece of malicious software that the bad guys could just piggyback on.
One of the friction points around this dynamic is with the right to repair and the right of owners of devices to repair them, which increasingly involves diagnostic software and codes and accurate documentation, has become a major point of friction between companies like John Deere and consumer advocates. What are your thoughts on that? Because often the justification for not wanting to reveal diagnostic codes or the workings of electronic devices is that by doing so, you're going to empower hackers to then compromise those devices.
Well, this is the excuse we've gotten in the computer industry. And it took us a couple of decades to beat it down because it was stupid, right? We don't want to reveal our code because the bad guys might see it, right? That's why we're not going to allow you to publish vulnerabilities. That's why we're not going to allow researchers to examine it. And we know that makes no sense. But yet now, right, we're seeing the IoT manufacturers, we're seeing it in voting machines right now, and here it's democracy at stake, right? We don't want to show you our source code because right. then the bad guys can see it.
Right.
And invariably, that's code for we don't want to show you our source code because we're embarrassed by it and we know you'll find stuff and you'll make us look bad in the media. It is bullshit. Right. We know that the best way to get security is through this kind of examination.
You talk a lot in this book, as well as your last book, about surveillance capitalism. And you make the point, I think, what you've made before, that really surveillance capitalism requires insecurity to function, that security is antithetical to the proper functioning of surveillance capital. Talk about how that influences this growing population of kind of devices and connected things that surrounds us.
So these examples we've been using are fit perfectly. John Deere or your Kindle. In order for those companies to control what you are and aren't doing with the device that they sold you, they need to spy on you. So they need to build monitoring into the things that you own. And, you know, they'll be put in there for consumer reasons. I went to a restaurant show last year, and there's a lot of restaurant equipment that has computers in it now. And it is all monitored, and what they advertise is we can better sell you replacement parts when it breaks. We could do better diagnostics. We can sell you the consumables. We know how you use it. But, you know, they also control how it's used. And then those are vulnerabilities. So the vulnerabilities are built in. Right? Google needs to spy on you in order for it to make money. So it's not going to put in security measures that prevent spying. Now, Google is happy to have you for you to have security, just not from them.
You're listening to the Security Ledger podcast. This week's podcast is sponsored by CyberSN. CyberSN specializes in permanent and contract staffing for cybersecurity, information security, and security sales professionals. With a national and international reach, CyberSN dramatically decreases the frustration, time, and cost associated with job searching and hiring for cybersecurity professionals. CyberSN's proprietary technology platform uses a cybersecurity common language to create job descriptions and understand the job seeker's actual experience. In short, CyberSN makes job searching and hiring simpler while creating higher retention rates. For more information, visit cybersn.com. In the past, we've read a lot about the dangers of technology monocultures. Obviously, Dan Geer wrote a very famous essay talking about Windows and the Windows monoculture whatever it was, 15 years ago. As we look at the Internet of Things, it strikes me right now that there certainly is not a monoculture, either in hardware or software, on the Internet of Things. But you say that we should not expect to see that last, and that eventually we may well end up with a Internet of Things monoculture, at least insofar as software and processors and so on go. Why is that? And is that a good thing or a bad thing for the security of the Internet?
It's the trend towards standardization. Likely, if an IoT manufacturer is making a new thing today, they're going to pull a standard part off the shelf. They're not going to design their own chips. They're going to, there will be, I think, always this monoculture. And I think this actually drives the IoT. And I'm asked all the time, why in the world does your refrigerator have an internet connection? And the reason is because the chip came with it. You know, 20 years ago, someone's designing a refrigerator, it will have electronics and computerization, but it would be some custom thing that was designed for that embedded system. Today, the manufacturer designer pulls a chip off the shelf, and it comes with an IP stack. It comes with video software. It comes with all of those things. So it's easy to add it because the marginal cost is so low. That'll be the same. That'll be why your toothbrush is on the internet. Because the chip that the manufacturer uses, for whatever reasons they're going to computerize that toothbrush, will come with an IP stack. And it'll come with software that allow you to control it from your iPhone. So you just get that for free. Now, I even when Dan Gear wrote about Windows and monoculture, I didn't really think it was that much a risk. Because the opposite of monoculture is diversity. So I think of primates. We have very few children and nurture them to adulthood. And lobsters that have 10,000 eggs and forget about them all and play the odds. So the monoculture is primates. Having four operating systems or a dozen doesn't help that much. You need 10,000. When you've got a million different operating systems, then we've got security and diversity. So whether the IoT monoculture is 1, 5, 10, or even 100, it's still not enough to really get that diversity. So there is a security risk when you have everything in one CPU, one operating system, one software package. But you don't get that much security if you have 10. You start getting that much security at 10,000.
We've talked about sort of the problems, but your book is also a lot about prescriptions for fixing these problems, right? So let's talk about some of those. You talk both about securing endpoints and then just securing the overall Internet Plus or Internet of Things or whatever you want to call it. First, on the endpoints, talk about how do we get more secure connected devices? Because as I look at it, it strikes me today that consumerism is really driving this market very aggressively, and that the security conversation is largely invisible, at least from the consumer's perspective. It is just not an issue that consumers shop or buy on, or even, as you point out, have any real way to evaluate.
And this is true for pretty much all industries. You go into a restaurant, you can't shop on food hygiene. I mean, if it's really obvious, you can, but basically you can't go to the kitchen and start inspecting it. Right? If you get on an airplane, you cannot make your purchase decision based on how safe the plane is. You don't have the expertise, and they're not going to let you look at the engine.
True.
So I argue that what's missing is government intervention. And this is a hard argument to make to a very, you know, computer industry, libertarian, government got out of my way crowd, but I think it is the only answer. There really exists no industry in the past century that's improved their security and safety without being forced to by the government. Think planes, think cars, think restaurants, pharmaceuticals, consumer goods, workplace, financial instruments. Again and again, companies will produce insecure bad products because the consumers can't tell the difference. And consumers will make buying decisions based on surface features, not based on security or safety. And it makes business sense for the companies to take the chance that nothing will happen and hope for the best. And so I have these tech solutions. There are a lot of tech solutions, but I can't get them implemented without government forcing companies to. But and here's the thing about regulation. Because now the internet affects life and property, I think regulation is inevitable. Governments regulate things that kill people. So the debate, which used to be regulation versus no regulation, will soon be smart regulation versus stupid regulation. And my real point in the book was to look at what regulation could be, how we could make it work, because I think it's inevitable. Because I think we have no choice but to accept it. So let's have the conversation now rather than after the disaster.
One of your prescriptions is really to think twice about our decisions to really connect anything to the internet. Right now, we sort of just assume that internet connectivity is like Baco Bits or something. You know, it just makes everything better. But you say probably not. And we should be very thoughtful about that decision to add an IP address to anything.
I think it's coming in two waves. I mean, no time soon, but certainly data that it's long believed that collecting data is good, right? That more data is better. That was the promise of big data. Collect it all, and you'll figure out how to monetize it. And it turns out that's A, not true, and B, data is a toxic asset, and collecting it has risks. And similarly, I think we'll eventually get to that same point with connectivity, that right now we are punch drunk on connectivity. And as you say, connecting something is an obvious good, and of course we should do it. But in the future, I think we'll make more conscious decisions. I mean, a reasonable analogy is nuclear power. Go back to the 1970s, and nuclear power was going to be the way our society was going to get power. It was an unbridled good. And then we had some disasters, Three Mile Island in particular, and nuclear power didn't go away, but it became just one of many options in a diverse power portfolio. And I think we're going to get to the same type of agreement and understanding with data and connectivity, that it's not obviously the right thing to do, that it might be, but we have to think about it more because it has positives and negatives.
You talk about the need for public education and better information. You talk about getting rid of information asymmetries with better labeling and product information, but also educating the public about their role in cybersecurity. That's a little bit of a boil the ocean problem, but how would you go about doing that? And what, to the extent that there is a kind of public health campaign here, what should it look like? What types of things should we be educating the public about?
Yeah, so I tend to think that educating and information is less to educate the public directly and more to give public advocacy organizations the information they need to educate the public. I mean, we're not going to be able to produce a consumer that is educated enough about these systems to know how to buy only secure things. I mean, just like I can't educate the average consumer in how to buy a safe pharmaceutical. It's just too much, and I can't give the consumer that kind of specialized knowledge. And I want labeling, but it's only going to be part of the solution. And exactly how it works, I think we don't know and need to figure out, if that makes any sense.
The analogy I think that some have used is the, you know, 5-star crash safety rating as an example.
You know, maybe, but it's very hard to do that in computer security. It's not linear like that. You have an adaptive and intelligent adversary. It's not just the environment. You know, people have looked at that, and it's hard to figure out how to make it work. I mean, I think we should keep looking at it, but I don't know. I think there's going to be limitations to it. It's definitely part of the solution.
Some of the pictures you paint of the future are concerning in particular, and I think you're right, you know, talking about the degree to which or the way in which attacks will become automated and really become the work of intelligent machines rather than teams of, you know, intelligent and skilled human beings, and that will really accelerate the advent of new threats and new attacks and make the job of defenders obviously that much harder. As you point out, this is not necessarily that far in the future that we're going to be facing that type of threat. How do you think we're, as a society, we can kind of get in front of computer-directed AI or machine learning-based, you know, threats and attacks?
Yeah, I'm not sure we can. AI is hard to predict because it's fundamentally nonlinear, right? Well, the effects surprise us, right? Go went from a game that is just impossible for computers to ever play because it was computationally explosive and infeasible to, oh yeah, we just did that last month without really any intervening theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think AI in computer security is going to be the same way.
Well, and also we're playing Go in ways that nobody ever thought to play Go before, right?
That's right. And the question to ask is, it's just kind of your question, will this eventually benefit the attackers or the defenders, right? Who will do better, right? AI-based attack versus AI-based defense. The answer is we don't know. I mean, certainly right now, defense is at such a disadvantage that I think the near-term improvements go to the defenders. To be able to respond to attacks at computer speeds will be enormous because already attacks are happening at computer speeds. If you think about AI for vulnerability finding, right, it benefits both the attacker and the defender. But once AI techniques start being regularly applied by the defenders, vulnerabilities go away. Right? It's possible, it seems weird, that within 5 years, the notion of a software vulnerability is, you know, something that used to happen before the AI started looking at all the source code. I don't know, but it's possible. On the other hand, there are lots of ways you can imagine adaptive attacks that a AI attacker can do things that we can't imagine right now and could be beyond our ability to defend. But the thing about AI is we just don't know. It is such a game changer in so many ways that we have no idea.
It strikes me that there's always this tension between the advantages that technology brings as well as then the risks and drawbacks of using it. And I'm thinking about, we had Tavi Kotka on this show, who was a former CIO of Estonia. You know, that's a country that's probably further ahead than anyone in terms of e-government and really bringing government services online, streamlining them, automating them in some places. It's really amazing to hear him talk. But you also point out there are risks with that. In particular, you know, Estonia had a big issue with the cryptography on their government-issued ID cards. Do we have to make our peace with a certain level of potential risk as we look to modernize and embrace and use technology? How do we balance that? How do we, you know, avoid going over the falls with our concerns about bad outcomes or, you know, huge attacks and so on?
I think we definitely have to live with certain risks. I mean, we do that. That's life, right? Life is risk, and we live with risks. What we want to avoid are catastrophic risks. So can we engineer these systems to fail safely, to fail securely, so that small failures don't cascade into larger failures? Now, how do we control or contain these natural risks, which I agree are inevitable, will always be there, and the alternative of not doing anything is worse, right? The reason computers are going into everything is because there's enormous value, and we want that value. So there is going to be some rethinking of security engineering in the same way that we drive automobiles, which are incredibly risky, mm-hmm. or we fly airplanes, which is mm-hmm. also incredibly risky, yet has become, it's probably a better example, the safest mode of travel because of the way we engineer airplanes, because of the decisions that are made on how systems fail. Right? Planes fail all the time. Airplane deaths are rare.
Yeah.
So there really is this rethinking of engineering that I think has to happen by governments forcing it. that it won't happen naturally, that the market won't be able to do this.
It really strikes me, in particular in the context or use case of voting, because I know Tavi Kotka was talking about the fact that, you know, in Estonia, they've been voting online since, I think, 2005 or something. And everybody does it from their computer and nobody thinks about it. And obviously, as far as we know, there haven't been any security issues associated with it. And then here in the United States, you know, we just got through the voting village at DEF CON. We're all kind of beating up on 15 or 20 year old electronic voting machines and gnashing our teeth about it instead of working on a solution that would both allow us to have secure votes, but also maybe more efficient, more accessible votes. It sort of strikes me that there's just like there's no captain at the wheel. There's nobody who's kind of directing our energies or activities. We're all just kind of falling about ourselves and pointing at the problems, but nobody really wants to move forward with a solution.
And that's, of course, the lack of coordination. I mean, voting is in a lot of ways a special case because in the United States, there is no government body that is entrusted with producing an accurate result. I mean, there's no unlike other countries, you know, we use the system of mutually distrusted people watching each other. And that worked great 50 years ago when they were mechanical and electromechanical machines. You could have a Republican and Democrat in the room watching the vote, and any shenanigans will be noticed by the other. Now, that worked fine. It fails today. With the modern threats, that security measure just fails. But changing it is political, right? You have one party in the United States that wants vote suppression, that wants voting to be onerous and hard, and doesn't want accessibility and turnout. So you almost really can't look at that as a test case because of all those political maneuverings. And you go out to some other industry, like nobody wants cars to crash. Like, nobody right. does, right? There is right. no constituency that says more car crashes are good for my political party. None. And even there, we have lots of security issues, right? Companies make the same stupid mistakes that the computer companies made 20 years ago. They make their software not patchable. They try to punish security researchers who are disclosing flaws. They're just doing the same things. They're designing software that has all these insecurities. And the question is why? Why didn't they learn? They didn't come from the computer industry. And yes, they care, right? If a car crashes because of a computer failure, they get blamed. But you know, they're playing the odds. They're hoping and they can weather a PR disaster because it'll be a bad actor. You know, I'm going to make this up. A terrorist decides to crash all the cars of this model year. I mean, the car manufacturer's not going to be blamed any more than American Airlines was blamed for 9/11. And they'll weather it. And it's just better business. So unless the Department of Transportation steps in and starts producing security regulations for connected cars, for computer-assisted cars, for network, for driverless cars, for all of these things, we're going to have disasters. You know, in general, I am hopeful. I think we will muddle through. I think regulation is coming, whether the industry likes it or not. I think there will be problems, insecurities, there will be deaths, but we will figure this out. I don't think that this issue will end our society. That I think that we are ingenious enough that if we are forced to solve the problem, we will.
Bruce Schneier, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us about your new book, Click Here to Kill Everybody.
Thank you.
Bruce Schneier is the author of 15 books, including his latest, Click Here to Kill Everybody. He's a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and a board member at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Bruce is a special advisor to IBM Security and the chief technology officer at IBM Resilient. Up next, It's common knowledge that there aren't enough information security professionals to fill all the jobs that our economy has created for them. That's put a premium on cybersecurity talent, especially in hot areas such as cyber forensics and incident response. But our next guest, Deidre Diamond of the information security placement firm CyberSN, says that finding cybersecurity talent is just half of the problem. Companies are just as challenged to hold on to that talent once they've acquired it. And, she says, they mostly have themselves to blame when information security pros walk. Too few companies have a clear definition of the information security roles they need filled and are too willing to let job descriptions and responsibilities drift or change once they've made a hire. That often leads to unfulfilled workers who are more than happy to take a call from a recruiter or keep their eyes peeled for a new opportunity that may come along. What's the secret to keeping cybersecurity talent within your company? In this conversation, Deidre and I talk about the need for companies to define their information security roles and to cultivate information security professionals within their organization once they've been hired. With Labor Day marking the unofficial end of summer, I asked Deidre whether fall was a busy hiring season or a time when information security workers might start to look around for new opportunities. 3, 2, 1. Deidre Diamond is the founder and CEO of CyberSN. She joined us to talk about the information security job marketplace.
Deidre Diamond, founder and CEO.
Deidre, welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I should say welcome back to the Security Ledger podcast.
Yay, it's great to be here.
So we're coming up on the unofficial end of summer, which is the Labor Day weekend here in the United States. And it is often when kids are heading back to school and grownups are kind of kicking the sand out of their shoes and thinking about heading back to work or even starting a new job. And I thought I'd start by asking you, because CyberSN is a placement firm. You help employers find workers and workers find employers. Is the end of the summer actually a busy time for you and a busy time for companies that are hiring new talent?
Great question. Traditionally, in all talent acquisition, never mind cyber, my experience has been that the third and fourth quarters are really busy from the perspective of losing budget, headcount budget. So most companies run on a calendar year budget cycle. And if they've been given headcount talent, that means they'll lose it in January. And so traditionally, it's summertime is a little bit slower. And then Q4, October, November, December are busy placements happening on, you know, holidays even, because people don't want to lose their headcount. At the same time, January, February, March is when hiring managers get approval for jobs that they've been dying to fill. They don't have enough staff and they get their new open recs. And so Q4, Q1 are traditionally the busiest of a calendar year for staffing in general. In cyber, we found that this summer was our busiest summer ever. We actually didn't see any slowdown. I believe that's from the number one reason of talent shortage, right? So, you know, we're gearing up. We expect that these next 3 or 4 months are going to be pretty crazy so that people don't lose their headcount.
Yeah, I mean, you anticipated my next question, which is you're not just a firm that is in the placement industry. You really focus on information security and everything we hear about employment in the information security sector is that there aren't enough workers to fill the positions. So also probably good time to ask you, is that turning around? Are we seeing improvement in both the supply of information security talent and placement?
Yeah, I wish I could say yes. The answer is no. It's very difficult to develop a information security professional that's a practitioner, more particularly on the engineering side, which is where the bulk of the jobs are. our schools don't have the capacity for hands-on experience, even if they're teaching cyber. And so there's this real challenge of absorbing new folks into systems. And really the challenge is that most organizations don't have a system. They don't have an onboarding for entry level or the ability to train and get value out of the person at the same time. And therefore, they're traditionally not hiring the entry level. And so there are in the Fortune 100 and some of the Fortune 500, we're seeing, the succession planning becoming a real focus. And yet we still have very poor retention rates. And so whenever I talk about talent acquisition in cybersecurity, I really focus my clients on retention is the way that we're going to acquire talent, meaning if you don't have a story to sell around how you're going to take this person's career on and a path for them that you're willing to discuss in the interview and map out in the interview, then I really can't help a client. So therefore, mm-hmm. I'd rather work with them to create that and then find talent. And so everything that we do is focused on that because we aren't narrowing the gap in new people. And all we're doing is moving around the people that we have in, an 18-month cycle. And it's been really interesting, Paul. The best thing that's happened to me in the last couple of years, being that I'm a sociologist and criminologist in my soul since I was a kid, that what humans do, why they do it, and certainly criminal behavior has been super fascinating to me, and then taking that into the business world of what we all do and how we all behave, right? And one of the best things that's happened to me in the last couple of years that's given me real hope is we developed a contracting arm, hope for retention and changing cultures in cyber for retention, is we opened a contracting arm. I personally, have been managing it for the last 2 years, and I never got in the contracting business and always thought it was sort of a using of humans, type of model. And so my clients really needed help with CapEx, OpEx. And I thought, maybe there's something else I can do here. Anyhow, mm-hmm. long story short is that the retention that's happening in my contract arm doubles and is about to triple as time goes on, the retention stats of perm placements. And it's for no other reason than I have a career program for them. I've created monthly training meetings. I've created budgets for certificates certifications and training. They have an extra person they can go to if they're having challenges at work. I work with the client that's hired them as contractors to make it such that they never feel like a contractor. And yet they have us, they know that we're here, we're giving them training, and hey, if a company isn't going to treat you right, well then of course we can certainly place you somewhere else. And so you can imagine how the contractor actually now has become feeling more secure than permanent. Isn't that interesting? Because it's really just more upfront planning, and it's not that much more, maybe 5 hours, 7 hours of leadership making a plan for security succession planning. That being said, people cut and paste job orders from web and hire people, and then it doesn't usually work out because the expectations are off, because the role's off, because that nobody was on the same page.
You're listening to the Security Ledger podcast. This week's podcast is sponsored by CyberSN. CyberSN specializes in permanent and contract staffing for cybersecurity, information security, and security sales professionals. With a national and international reach, CyberSN dramatically decreases the frustration, time, and cost associated with job searching and hiring for cybersecurity professionals. CyberSN's proprietary technology platform uses a cybersecurity common language to create job descriptions and understand the job seeker's actual experience. In short, CyberSN makes job searching and hiring simpler while creating higher retention rates. For more information, visit cybersn.com. obviously one of the big pipelines to companies of new workers comes from colleges and universities and junior colleges, where you would expect that there would be a steady stream of young, eager information security professionals or people with the necessary skills coming onto the market. Do you see that? And if so, is the market really ready to deal with the needs of millennial InfoSec workers?
Well, so most schools don't have an information security bachelor. The information security is under a software engineering title, typically, or excuse me, you know.
It's like part of the CS department.
Yeah, and it's maybe two or three classes. So I don't see the schools moving faster and getting on top of this. I see not-for-profits or government-funded training institutes popping up a lot. Good, you know, they're doing good work. They're seeking to bridge the gap. And yet the challenge I still see for them is the experience of real data, experience of real hands-on, assembly of what it looks like to be out in the workforce versus get a certification on 10 different things in 8 weeks. You know, it doesn't help people that are out in the workforce. So what do you have? You have security engineers, still spending part of their days as eyes on glass or incident responders or lead analysts in security operations centers still responding to tickets all day long, or 70% of their day is responding to tickets. And that's not what they want to be doing. So, but how do they take an entry level person to do that job? The learning curve is significant. It's years. This is the problem. And these folks in the SOC with experience are now finding themselves a year, 2 years, 3 years into not being able to get out of the work that is not interesting, not what they got into the business for. And so we're starting to see a lot of people really seek to know exactly what they're going to be doing and understand how the operation works. But the schools haven't caught up, and even the specialized institutes are still, it's a very entry-level person. It requires experience. This is the challenge.
Because I know we've talked before, and you've spoken a lot about that one of the big mistakes that organizations make is that they just don't really have a clear idea, actually, of what the job it is that they're hiring or what job they're hiring for, what the responsibilities are, what skills they need. As you said, often they kind of just cut and paste job descriptions or throw 30 different things into one job description, and it's a job that nobody could possibly be qualified to do. Is that the root of the problem, or is it that plus a whole bunch of cultural issues that are just sort of part of the, you know, workforce, part of the work experience, at least in this country, that aren't a good fit for information security work?
I think it's the root. I absolutely think it's the root. If you talk to somebody that's currently wants to leave their job or just left their job, and you say, so why did you leave? And a lot of the times say, it just wasn't a good fit for me. And if you dig into that, what it comes down to is the role isn't what I want to do. And if you dig even further and keep pulling back the onion peel, if you will, you'll find that either one of two things happen. When they first took the job was different than it is today, which I see happening in the workforce all the time, right? So grabbing people from what they're doing on a regular basis because some big project comes in, we need to, you know, onboard a new vendor, we need to evaluate a product, and now all of a sudden, instead of me being lead incident responder, I am a project manager of, you know, onboarding a new vendor and how they integrate and work with our Splunk system because I'm the best at Splunk. Right? Or I'm good at Splunk. So now I'm over here doing this project management stuff and I can't get out of it. It was told that it was going to be 6 months. It's a year. I don't see any change really. And this isn't what I want to be doing. So you'll see that if you peel back the onion, it's such that it changed. It was the right role. And then it changed. They got pulled to do another project. And who wants to say no? Everybody wants to be a team player. They want to help out. However, they don't want to do that for 6 months or a year. Never mind like losing that skill that they had before. I mean, in information security, you got to stay with it or you lose it. You'll see that, or you'll see that it was never the job that they said it was in the interview. So you can peel back the onion and ask questions and that will get you the answer that no, the job that I'm doing is the same job I've been doing since I got here. And it's not the job I was told in the interview. And so everything I see comes back to this fundamental, very detailed role and responsibility down to the percentage of time that one is going to be doing that job. And then if that needs to change, then it needs to change and it needs to be documented. And then there just needs to be open dialogue as to, you know, whether or not that change actually works for that person, checking in with them. So they've been doing something different for 30 days. They've been doing something different for 90 days. They did the team a favor by taking on this project. Well, you better check in with that person and care to figure out, do they like it? Maybe they want to stay in that role. So what happens is people don't check in. They just assume they're okay with it. And then lo and behold, they get a phone call and, you know, or they start browsing jobs and start, you know, being open to the conversations of their, you know, within their network. And they're going to be gone very quickly at that moment. You know, when you lost touch with that person. And it all comes down to what they're doing on a daily basis.
Do you think sometimes companies don't ask because they don't want to hear the answer or they're afraid of hearing the answer?
Yeah, for sure. I think we've got a real, you know, challenge with just soft skills in general and people's willingness to actually care for the people that they oversee and be accountable for caring for them versus being, you know, a manager, being a leader. And so I think that in many situations, we have people that really don't care. And then I think we have fear, of course. You know, I don't want to hear my best guy, you know, I know he probably doesn't love this project. And yet if I acknowledge it, and then I don't do something about it, well, I like this person, so that doesn't feel good. So I'm just going to avoid it and hope that a little bit longer, and then he'll be off of it or she'll be off of that project. And that little bit later is typically when the person's done and gone. And the other thing that we see a lot, and people, it's good timing for this question, is that the end of the year is the number one time where people make their decision of I'm leaving, because we've grown up in America as the new year is the shedding of the old, you know, it's the resolutions, whatever doesn't make me happy today must make change on that. And so I tell people all the time, never let your teammates go into the holiday. Certainly going home and meeting catching up with family. Well, what do we all do? We talk about our jobs. We talk about our careers. Like, family, you know, holiday time is a lot of sharing what we all do for a living, you know? And so I tell organizations, you got to get ahead of it before the new year. It is scientifically proven. I see it in staffing statistics that it's the end of the year. If somebody doesn't go into their holiday season really enjoying their job, they're starting the new year job searching.
So if your star guy has a cup of eggnog in his hand and hasn't had the, you know, where are you going in this job? What do we have in store for you conversation yet? You've got a big problem.
Yeah, because that person is going to go home for the holidays and grandma, parents, brothers, sisters, in-laws, spouses, everybody's going to be talking about, you know, how are things going with you? What's happening? How's your job? You know?
Yeah, and that makes you think about it. How is my job? Actually, it's not great.
Yes, and then you start thinking about it, and then you share. And it's like once a human starts verbalizing that, holy moly, it just becomes reality.
We've kind of talked around the shortage of workers, but to get a little specific, where is the need the greatest? What positions are organizations most in need of? And you know, from your standpoint, when you get an employee or a potential employee, what types of skills are the easiest to find a place for?
So, easiest to find a place for is interesting. It's really the organizations that are open to remote partially during a week or 100%. Those roles are the easiest for us to fill. In fact, I'm about to launch a real-time salary guide that's based on geography, as well as do you get to work remote, to show the community how many remote workers there actually are. I don't think that people really understand that A, there's quite a few, and B, that's what people want, to empower organizations to do more of it, because there still isn't enough of it. So when there's remote work available, easy peasy. And again, anything's easier for us because we have a an army here infiltrated in cyber, and 89% of the market doesn't love their job. So, you know, and we pick our clients. So for us, everything's relatively easy after, you know, the years of building the operation. That being said, if I'm an individual recruiter working in an organization or an organization by myself, your easiest shot is having either 100% remote or certainly some portion. And then the roles that are newest that we're seeing really pop up is insider threat. And not just pop up in onesies, twosies, but building large departments and really investing in insider threat, which is super cool to see. And watching these leaders that we've been working with sort of take people from different traditional information security roles and putting them into an insider threat program. And so that's been fun for them and us a lot. That's really fun, actually.
So these are people with a background in forensics and areas like that?
Yeah, or analysts, engineers, really anybody, even risk. It's much more investigative, so you think forensics. Really, it's sort of a team of every type of skill set in insider threat.
A-team. It's an A-team.
Yeah, yeah. It's like these A-teams. And of course, who doesn't want to be on that? Because you're not sitting and looking at tickets all day. You know, I can't stress enough how information security is in ticket hell, you know, and it's really hurting us. So, yeah, those roles are easy for us from the perspective of the role sells itself. Of course, the analyst roles are still the most abundant roles because we haven't figured out yet technology to save so much of the work of what other, you know, what technology has created, right? The digging through data. Mm-hmm.
I know you've done a ton of work over the years to really promote the presence, the prevalence of women and diversity in general in information security, but specifically gender diversity. We did have Parisa Tabriz as the keynote speaker at Black Hat. I thought she gave a really amazing talk. I'd be interested in your thoughts on both her talk and kind of how that project is going, both Brain Babes and also just the general project of trying to increase the presence and visibility of women in the field.
Brainbabe.org continues to support both men and women, but certainly focusing on women in bringing them into our industry and working conferences and utilizing that job stream to introduce. And that's going wonderful. I couldn't be happier. More and more people getting involved, and not just because of the diversity piece, also because they're hiring people anyway. So I'll take it however I can get it. That being said, the numbers show that we don't have more women coming in. So we're not winning on the numbers piece. We are winning in that I sort of pulled a lot of women that went to Black Hat and DEF CON to see if there was any feelings that weren't positive. And this year I saw, I would say 90%, the majority had positive things to say, whereas last year it was 50-50. And so I really believe that our culture is conscious of the problem. And because we're conscious, we're getting better, you know, sort of interactions. The reality is that the statistics will only prove success, meaning when we see more women coming in, when we see more women being retained, and then when we see more women going past middle management, which we have not seen those statistics raise in any great capacity, we will know that we're, you know, achieving. Right now it feels like achievement, and yet the numbers haven't caught up.
Deirdre Diamond, so great to talk to you again. Thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Deirdre Diamond is the founder and CEO of CyberSN. She joined us to talk about the information security job marketplace.